my, you know, I had some say in practice, who unfortunately nowadays can only be seen for short sessions.
Would you like white or red wine? Oh, you've heard.
I'll have some red, thank you.
Right, okay.
It's a double drink.
Have you got a larger glass?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The other thing work I do is what they call one of
the
companies that go the companies go into EAP work, it's called.
Mm-hmm.
David, you're joining us?
All sorts of organizations. In fact, most organizations have
David?
Such a company.
But I'm
not
drinking.
Okay, fine. What would you have? Would you like whiskey or wine?
And that means that you suddenly get
red
or white.
It's too bad. Red is one semi sweet.
I don't know if there's any real.
I'm not an expert in wine, so.
Well, this wine
it's the effect I want.
With Kabbalah salt. For the minute. There is a. Marion, would you like some wine?
Could I have it in this?
Or in this?
Is yeah, in that, in that.
Yeah,
yes.
Now, would you like white or red?
Red, please. In a small amount. Thank you.
I don't know.
Natalie, would you like some wine?
Oh, yes, please.
Red, white?
Red.
Oh, no!
Yeah, I know.
Have they still got to the flat yet?
Oh, look.
Well,
this is what they said. It's so rude. Sorry.
Katie, would you like some wine?
No, thank you.
David, some wine?
A little white. Very small, please. Fine. A lot.
A cuba?
You'll share with me.
Yossi, would you like some wine? Or whiskey? What would you like?
He's playing merrily because he can be outside the sukkah, but indoors in the warm.
We went to a sukkah party with him on Sunday night. And there wasn't room for him in the sukkah, and he was outside in the garden, and it was jolly cold.
Questions, do you have to start to educate your son before bar mitzvah? You have to educate them in drinking wine.
Wine or in vino veritas. What would you like?
Don't worry. You have to be happy.
This is wine. It's not very strong.
Yeah.
White?
Except that we've got some here already, so maybe you should keep that on.
You have to have a Rabbi's anyway.
Because we've got.
Yeah, if you'd like to pass this to Yossi, thank you very, very much.
I think in the Talmud they would give them nuts, is that right? To make the children happy. It was like the candy of the day. Nuts, walnuts, you know, it's really exciting.
Okay, so we start off in a minute. First of all, we make a bracha, boirim inem zonot, and then leishe basukah. In order to make the bracha leishe basukah, you have to end up eating an egg size or weight of cake. So that's about 2 ounces. See, we're trying to make the finite be a vehicle for the infinite. So that means everything's got a measure, how much, when, exactly, you know. So Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech HaOlam Boireh Min HaMazonos. Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech HaOlam Asher Kedosh Adonai HaMitzvot V'Tzivonu Leishev Basukah.
Amen.
I love the drawing.
Is that elephant yours?
Mm.
It's really nice.
Yeah,
like, mm.
I like the elephant.
Oh, wow, the elephant with lulav. Elephant shaking lulav. And an elephant with his tail. Is it a tail?
If you've got somebody who
has
only entitled to a limited number of sessions.
L'chaim, l'chaim. So here we are in the beautiful environment of this very lovely Lipkin Sukkah. Our host is a descendant of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, the founder of the Musa movement. Yes. So we have here all the streams of Eastern European spirituality moving together. There's Musa and Chabad coming together.
So when does Musa begin?
Around 1850, 1845, something like that.
Can you tell us a little about what distinguishes Musa from...
Well, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, you see, the point is the Hasidic movement began around 1750, approximately. And it saw that in Jewish life, you have Talmud study and halachic study, but you also needed an extra dimension. That extra dimension was very important. And the extra dimension that the Hasidim supplied was Pnimiyut HaTorah, the inwardness of Torah, the Kabbalistic dimension, in a particular style, the Hasidic style. And the difference between Hasidut and Kabbalah is that while Kabbalah is essentially for an elite of people who are major scholars and have achieved inner self-mastery, and then they're able to enter into the depths of Kabbalah, Hasidism takes the deepest essence of Torah teaching, including the Kabbalah, and makes that accessible to everyone, and it can be communicated to every person. There's a very beautiful discourse, actually, by the Rebbe, which was published as on the sea. It's called in Yonah Shel Torah HaChassidus. What's that in English? It was a book, and it's a book in English translated by very famous English scholar
on the essence of Hasidus.
On the answer, yeah, thank you. On the essence of Hasidus. And it was translated by the young woman who wrote Slayers of Moses. Famous literary theorist writer. A woman lives in Israel now.
Yes, I know who you mean. It'll come back to me in a minute.
Okay. Anyway, she translated it. And there is a point where the Rebbe takes the Mode Ani, it's in English, it's translated, the Mode Ani prayer, and shows that you can understand it from the level of pshat, the simple level, Remez, the hint, Drush, the deeper exploration, Soid, the esoteric level, and at each level there is a Hasidic dimension. So it's not that there's Pshat, Remez, Drush, Soid, and then Hasidism. There's a Hasidic dimension to the Pshat, and to, you know, on every level there's a Hasidic dimension. A very, very beautiful book. And what it explains there is that the Hasidic level, you know, that there are the different levels of the Sfirot. So that beyond is the Sfira Keter, crown. And that is like half an expression of the radiance of the infinite and half with the limitations of world or turning towards world. That Chasidus is basically Hamshachas HaKeter, drawing down this spiritual, very, very intense spiritual level at every level of Jewish thought and human life. So that was what the Hasidim believed and believe is the way to rejuvenate the Jewish people and bring the Messiah, is by bringing this extra dimension of spirituality into the world. Now, this was resisted by a number of Kabbalists who thought it was exactly the wrong thing to do, such as the Vilna Gaon, who was a leading halachist and Kabbalist, a scholar, a Talmudic scholar, a very great Talmudic scholar and a Kabbalist. And a colleague of mine in the university world he sees himself as sort of promoting the faith of the Mitnagdim. If you like, he's my sparring partner. You know, I promote the faith of the Mitnagdim, he promotes faith of the Mitnagdim. So he writes this absolutely beautiful passage in his book. He says, the Mitnagdim and the Hasidim believed both in exactly the same way. They both believed that the inner dimension of Torah is the most exalted, that communicating the inner dimension of the Torah was very important and would bring the Mashiach. They both believed that. But, as he puts it, the Hasidim were optimists and the Mitnagdim were pessimists. Why? The Mitnagdim thought that if you communicate the esoteric dimension of Torah, so then you're going to get all kinds of dangerous manifestations. So you have to rein it back and hide it and conceal it and just keep it for very learned scholars, etc. Whereas the Hasidim were optimists and they said, you know what, you can do it, you'll have a few safeguards here and there and you'll be able to communicate these teachings and you'll manage. So as a result, there was a large section of Torah scholars and like communities around them where they didn't study the inwardness of Torah at all. Now, so this one went from sort of 70 and it's sort of or only on a few, you know, the elite, a few, but it wasn't part of society. And then as a result of this, they became somewhat denuded from the necessary spirituality which is in order to maintain a Jewish lifestyle in a healthy way. Because previously, you see, there had been quite a bit of a spiritual dimension in Eastern European thought and life. And so the rise of Hasidism and the criticism of Hasidism tended to sort of polarize things, so that there were some people who were studying a lot of spirituality and other people not studying any, except for the very exalted elite. So Reb Chaim of Volozhin wrote, who was the successor of the Vilna Gaon, he wrote a Kabbalistic book, Nefesh L'Chaim, but that was a rarity, that people did study it, but it wasn't the norm. The norm was a new kind, actually quite revolutionary and itself controversial, kind of analytic Talmudic scholarship, which itself has its own fascinating dimension, which, if we could say, Hasidic spirituality has in a sense conquered much of the Torah world, the analytic style of Torah analysis, of Talmud analysis, has also conquered the Jewish world. So they have actually been in a sharing process. So in 770 they are quite likely to study a Lithuanian analysis of a piece of Talmud as well. Now So then around 1850, the Rebbe Maharash, hi, come in, Shalom Aleichem, that's so wonderful to see you. The Rebbe Maharash lived at the same time as Yisrael Salanter. Rebbe Yisrael Salanter saw that there was a terrible poverty among the Torah scholars of this spiritual input, and he began creating this Musa movement based on principles of psychology to a certain extent, and all kinds of, and a quest for inwardness with a background of Kabbalah, pietistic Kabbalah, but with the Kabbalah hidden, so that you could study Musa without reading anything of its Kabbalistic background. So it was like the Bechein. It was the sort of the active dimension that would come out of Kabbalistic pietist study, but without actually talking about Kabbalistic issues. A very great Musa figure of the present was Rabbi Eliyahu Dessler, and Zichroni Livracha. Now, Rabbi Eliyahu Dessler, he was in Gateshead, and he wrote a book called Michtav Eliyahu, and it's translated with the name Path to Truth or something like that. And he took a lot of his teachings from Tanya and Chabad Hasidic teachings, which I don't think he actually says in print, but he did tell quite a number of people about it, including a young man who was an artist and who was painting his portrait. And this young man was very much influenced by Chabad, Mordechai Beck. And he was very much influenced by Chabad. And so he visits Rabbi Dessler and sits with him several hours painting his portrait, beautiful portrait. And in the course of this, Rabbi Dessler tells him that a lot of his thought comes from Tanya and Hasidic book.
So crossing over from one tradition to the other.
Yeah, kind of cross-fertilization. But it's all Eastern European spirituality coming from the Zohar and Lurianic writings, you know, blending into... The question is, how do you take 1,000,000 volts and bring them into people's daily life? You know, so that's the question. What kind of insulation or checks and balances are needed? So all this comes up because our host is a descendant of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, and the founder of the Muslim movement. So in fact, there's a story about Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. He lived at the time of the Rebbe Maharash, Rabbi Shmuel, who was the fourth Lubavitcher Rebbe. Now there's a concept of a shpizin, spiritual guests in the sukkah. And each day there are different guests who come into the sukkah, each night that begins in the night, goes on through the day. In fact, all the guests are there. But according to Yesod V'Shoyresh HaAvodah by Alexander Ziskind, which is another, this is a book written in a way at the beginning before Hasidism and before the opponents of Hasidism and before Musa. According to him, someone pointed out to me in Shul, you have to actually invite these guests to come. So the leading guests of tonight, there's Avraham, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, Aaron, Joseph, David. Those are the seven guests which are universal from the Zohar. Everyone talks about them. And in Chabad, there are also seven Hasidic guests who are the Baal Shem Tov, the Magid of Mezirich, Rabbi Shneur Zalman, the founder of Chabad, the Mittler Rebbe, the Tzemach Tzedek, the Maharash, Rabbi Shmuel, and Rabbi Shalom Dov Be'er. So tonight is the night of the seventh day of Sukkot. And so, in fact, the main one of these guests, on the one hand, is King David, Sfirat HaMalchut, the attribute kingship, and on the other, it's the Rebbe Rashab. So, Rav Shalom Dover, we'll talk a bit about both of them at some point, but they are inviting in all the others. So, with Rav Shalom Dover comes the Rebbe Maharash. Now, the Rebbe Maharash, his father of Rav Shalom Dover, lived at the same time with Rav Yisrael Salanter. And once, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter and the Rebbe Maharash, he was the Ushpizin yesterday, or the day up till this evening, So, but he's also here with us in the sukkah now that we've invited them all in. So, I hope you move over and
make room for them all.
Yeah, that's right. Now, you see, there are some people who can see them. And the Rebbe once said, I think it's good to sit in a sukkah with someone who can see the spiritual guests. He meant the previous Rebbe, you know, we mean the Rebbe. You know, so thank you. So the Rebbe Marash and Rabbi Yisrael Salanter were once staying at the same hotel, over Shabbos, I think it was. And the hotel was mobbed with Hasidim who wanted to see the Rebbe Marash. And Rabbi Yisrael Salanter sat alone in his room studying, and there were many followers of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter in that same town, but they didn't dream of bothering him, over Shabbat, you know, the great rabbi, they're not going to bother him. So the Hasidim said, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was actually the soul of a Hasidic Rebbe. But he had come to be in this world of the Mitnagdim who didn't appreciate what a Rebbe was. And so therefore they left him alone. Whereas the Hasidim of the Rebbe Marash come, crowd to him, you know, see every movement and hear something from him, ask him a blessing or whatever it might be. So that's a point where two great streams of Jewish thought come together. There were many different forms of Musa that grew up from Rabbi Yisrael Salanter's initial guidance, coming to our main Ushpiz of the Hasidic Ushpiz in Rabbi Sholem Dover. He was once at a meeting of Rabbonim in Russia, and they were discussing things about the Hasidic, the yeshiva curriculum. And there was a discussion whether or not Musa should be on the curriculum of the yeshiva. This was a very intense issue because there were some people who said, we don't want Musa to be on the curriculum of the yeshiva. Musa, it probes too close into your heart. I don't want people invading me. In the Telza yeshiva, around 1904, something like that, they tried to, or maybe a few years earlier, they tried to introduce Musa. And there was a rebellion in the yeshiva, and the Bacharim refused to have Musa as a central part of the curriculum. Yeah, if someone wants to go and learn Musa or hear a Musa Shmiz, fine, but we're not going to be invaded by Musa probes, you know, trying to change our consciousness. And this is all written about by a person who left the Patel's yeshiva and various other aspects of traditional Judaism, became a famous academic in the Hebrew University. So he wrote his memoirs describing the rebellion in the Telz Yeshiva, how they rejected having Musa forced on them. So there was a discussion with later on, I think, with a gathering of rabbis discussing whether or not to have Musa in the yeshiva, and they voted no. They're not going to have Musa as a compulsory part of the curriculum. So the Rebbe Rashram got up, he said, he's leaving the meeting. Ein yiras elokim b'mokom hazeh, he said, there's no fear of God in this place. If they're not, I would prefer, you know, like, it's as if he's saying, I would prefer they would study Hasidic teaching. But if they're not going to study Hasidic teaching, at least let them study Musa. If they're definitely not going to study Musa, I'm not having anything to do with this meeting. And he walked out of the meeting. So there you have Chabad and the Musa movement.
So nowadays, do they teach Musa and Chabad
Chassidus? Well, you see, Chabad Chassidus actually includes a lot of Musa in itself. There are many mamorim, many discourses, which sort of probe very deeply into a person, just in the Musa style. It's it's not exactly the Musa style. One of the differences, it says in Hayom Yom, between Musa and Chabad, is that Musa shows the negative, and you want to run away from the negative. The negative in one's own heart, the negative in one's relationship with other people. How could you do such a thing? How could you be such a worthless person? There's this beautiful story about Musa. Someone comes into a Musa yeshiva, and everyone is there saying, I'm nothing. Oi, I'm nothing. So he thinks, this is really good. I'm going to do that as well. I'm nothing. They turned around and said, hey, who are you? You just got here. Who do you think you are saying you're nothing? So Musa is, in a sense, you know, it's running away from the negative. Hasidism shows the light. That's the idea, that you see the illumination, the beauty which is there, and you move towards the illumination. Of course, at some point, it must be that in Musa there is also the light, and it must be also that in Chabad you also have to face the nitty gritty inside oneself as well, and deal with that, but or try to deal with that. So l'chaim, l'chaim. Here we are in this very beautiful Lipkin Sukkah, and we are surrounded by Ushpizin, and our own guests who are here. L'chaim, l'chaim. Yossi, would you like to play a niggun?
Can you pour me a little bit of red wine?
Absolutely, yes, we got plenty.
Thank you very much. Stop.
This is Michelle from Southgate. This is my wife, Kate. That's Natalie and Marion. Michelle knows Esther Kessler-Berber. People very often have found themselves on opposite sides of the firing line in our long history. And I remember a joke about during the First World War, so there were Jews on the German side of the line fighting, and there were the Jews on the British side of the line fighting. And there was one of these Jews, I can't remember which side, who kept getting a lot of prisoners of war. And, you know, and he was really due for a medal, you know, because he kept catching these enemy soldiers. And they said to him, how do you do it? He said, well, I just go to the front between the two armies and I say, anyone can join a minion, I've got to say Kaddish. Well, that's by way of introduction to Rabbi Avraham Citron, who for a number of years, my wife and I have known him, because he and his wife, they were the rabbi, the rabbinic leadership of Belfast in Northern Ireland. And our daughter and son-in-law are the youth rabbi in Southern Ireland, in Dublin. So despite this, the conflict-laden possibilities that there are in this situation, of course there's a peace process going on in my university, UCL. They have a course in comparative peace processes. Compare the Irish peace process with the Israeli peace process. So, and it's run by an Irish scholar. But very often they would, in fact, do joint events together, and that's where Kate and I met. Rabbi Avraham and his wife, they would, bring a whole party of Jews from Belfast to some event that was taking place in Dublin, and it was a very warm atmosphere. However, now Rabbi Citron is here in London with us, and we are giving him the floor of the sukkah.
Thank you very much for inviting me, despite the fact that I'm from Northern Ireland. And thank you very much. It's a wonderful feeling in the sukkah. I love the wooden sukkah and it's wonderful, and the music as well. I when I was in high school, Yossi Nigon was one of the older Bacharim who was there to help us out in our studying and everything, and every once in a while we'd have a Hasidic farbring and a get together, and the Rosh Yeshiva would ask that he take out his violin and play. So it's great to be back to hear him once again. I thought maybe I'd just share with you two stories. One of them more sort of like on the theme of Sukkot, and then another one on Sukkot itself. I don't have to tell you what the theme of Sukkot is, but you know, on the first night of Sukkot, second night, we have to have in mind, and the rest of the days we should have in mind and think about what you're doing sitting in a sukkah. What do we think about? We went out of Egypt, God took us out of Egypt, and he surrounded us with the clouds of glory. So he showed his love for us, and we in turn, of course, we showed our love for him. We went out in the desert. We followed him, you know, it was this like love affair. We just ran out into the desert after him, not knowing what it's going to be like, and just put our total trust in him. And in fact, you know, he was there for us, and he protected us, and he had the clouds on top, like the schach. He had the clouds around us, like the four walls. And I believe there are some people who actually make a big deal out of the floor of the sukkah as well. No, it's not the Chabad custom. Some people make specifically, because in fact there was also a cloud which went on the floor and made it easy for them to travel, whatever that means, but somehow. So you know, it's really about putting your trust in God. And then every sukkah we do that, because every sukkah we go out there, leave the comfort of our own house, and we go into the sukkah, we go into the outdoors, because we're saying to God, we're putting ourselves in your hand and reminding ourselves of all that and of that love that God had for us and that we hope to reciprocate and show to God. You know, and sometimes you feel low, and like, you know, Sukkot is really, it's a very, to me at least, it's a very uplifting festival. It really brings joy. And, you know, just reminding how whatever situation you are in, God is always there for you. You know, it's the Hasidic thing about the minimum in halacha for a sukkah is the two walls plus a hand breadth for the third wall. And I think was it the Alter Rebbe who explained that that's like God's embrace with his one arm, one side, two sides, and then the hand breath. That's God's. When we're sitting here, this is, we're there, you know, we're in the desert, and this is God surrounding us, so to speak, and showing us his love. And of course it's King David tonight, as you said, and you know, whenever you're feeling down, it's King David. You go straight to Psalms. You just feel, you go with him through his pain, and you know, and everything he's going through, but you see in him, you see his hope, you see how he always has that absolute trust in God. You know, you're gonna be there for me. So I thought I'd say just one little story about faith in God, and then a little story about Sukkos. So the story, I believe it's with the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of the Hasidic movement, where he takes his close students every once in a while on a little trip to teach them some important lesson in service of God. So he takes them once, gets on the wagon, away they travel, they end up in some inn. There's a Jewish innkeeper serving them drinks. He's very excited. He says, I haven't had visitors in a long time, and here I have a group of rabbis. He doesn't know who they are, of course, but, and he's bringing out the drinks and everything. In the middle of the meal, like a policeman or a soldier of some sort walks in, and he takes his gavel or whatever he has, his stick, and he pounds on the table three times. Everybody's quiet. They have no idea what's this all about. He walks out. So they turn to the innkeeper and say, well, what's happening? So he says, nothing. Said, what do you mean nothing? A policeman just walks in and bangs on the table three times, says nothing. He says, well, my rent is due today. It's actually not due today. It's due a couple months ago, but this is the deadline. And if I don't pay by tonight, so the pirates, the local squire, is going to throw me into jail. And what are you doing about it? Says, well, nothing much. There's nothing I could do about it. Business has been bad. But God will provide. What's there to worry about? A couple hours go by. The Hasidim are getting more involved. The wine bottles are flowing. Wine is flowing. And the policeman walks back in and pounds on the table. And the guy just doesn't... It's as if, like, the policeman wasn't there. He's like, no problem. So he says, but aren't you worried? He says, what do you mean worried? I have till tonight. What do you mean? But you have hundreds of rubles you have to pay. So what's the problem? I mean, let's enjoy the moment. Make a long story short. Finally, he looks at his watch and he says, oh, it's time for me to go to the pirates. And they're saying, what about the money? Of trust in God. What about the money? So they're all very excited because they know that the Baal Shem Tov brought them here to see something extraordinary in the service of God. So, you know, they're like peeking and following and looking from far to see. They want to know what's going to happen. And they see from far a wagon heading towards this Jewish innkeeper. And the wagon stops, and you can see that there's a conversation going on, and they're very excited. You know, something's going on. Short while later, the innkeeper walks off, and then not too long later, he comes back, and he's like, "Okay, let's get back to the Farbrengen. Let's." They say, "No, come on, we have to tell us what happened." He says, "What happened? I went to pay the pirates, but you left without any money." He says, well, I met on the way, I met a guy who every once in a while buys whiskey from me. And he said, listen, I have a big event coming up. I know your whiskey, you distill it, just, you know, the Irish whiskey. It's like the real good whiskey. So I'd like to buy it from you. He says, well, I'll sell it to you for 300 ruble, which is exactly the amount of money he needs to pay his rent. He says, that's, you know, it's a little bit high. He says, well, that's how much I need. So he says, all right, your whiskey is better than, you know, anybody else's. He gives me the money. Off I went, and I paid the pirates. So here it is. The Baal Shem Tov, of course, doesn't need to tell his students. This is faith in God. You know, you don't have to worry. You have full trust in God. And if you have that faith, things will work out. If you don't have it, then God will still provide, but maybe not in such an open and revealed way.
Before we go on to Rabbi Brown's second story, I mean, one moral of the story is you've got to make good whiskey. And it's a very interesting thing that in the British Library there is a manuscript of Tanya. Now, there are 10 such manuscripts in the world. 8 are in the Rebbe's Library in New York, 1 is in the British Library in London, 1 is in Haifa, in the University Library. Now, the manuscript of Tanya is very similar in many ways to the printed Tanya, but there are certain differences which have been written about by scholars. But at the end of this one in the British Library, there's an extra page with writing on it, and no one was able to work out what the writing was. So the first person who looked at it, Herschel Gorman, who lives around here, he thought it was maybe a medical, a recipe for some kind of medical thing. Anyway, so I had to write something about this manuscript, and so I consulted quite a number of Hasidic scholars and also a professor of Yiddish in the Hebrew University, and we worked out that what it is, it's a recipe for lemon liqueur. So if you got the lemon liqueur, if you got the right kind of whiskey or liqueur, you know, so your bit, if we can just accept it, your bit that you have to do as well as you can. You have to make beautiful whiskey or lemon liqueur or something or other. And the rest, you lean up to Hashem and it'll all work out. L'chaim. Shall we have a niggun before the next story? Yeah, Yossi, would you like to play a niggun, please? Thank you very much. it's the Rashab. Oh, yeah. Especially associated with the Rebbe Rashab, the sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe, fifth Lubavitcher Rebbe. Thank you. Okay, back to Rabbi Sitchin.
We were speaking about before the Ushpizin, the special guests. And of course, a sukkah never feels like a sukkah. A proper Yom Tov if you don't have guests in your sukkah. There's a story, I think it's from Pinchas of Karetz. You could correct me if you recognize the story, but someone else. But he, like all Hasidic rabbis, was always pestered by large crowds of people, always after him, following his every step and asking for guidance, etc. Came one Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, and he said, "It's enough. I want to serve God. You know, I want to. What do I need all this for?" So he prays to God, and he says, "God, let Reb Yisrael have peace. You know, Reb Pinchas, let things be. People shouldn't like me anymore. What do I need it for?" So, of course, he's a tzaddik. He prays to God. God fulfills his request. And it was beautiful, that Rosh Hashanah. He really prayed. That Yom Kippur was mamish. It was the best of the best. Because nobody bothered him. Wrapped in his talus. He davened. And wonderful. He came closer to Sukkot, though. And he was getting into trouble. First of all, every year he used to have everybody fighting over the privilege, the honor, to build his sukkah. And to put on the schach. And this year, people were crossing the street when they saw him. Nobody wanted to talk to him. So, what does he do? And every person he asks, each one says, "I'm sorry, Rabbi." Whatever, you know, they come up with some good excuse. And finally, he has to find a non-Jewish guy. And he has to pay him a lot of money until he agrees to do it. And I think in Kabbalah as well, the walls of the sukkah represent, is it the letters in the name of God? I don't know, but anyways, he was always particular in general that a Jewish guy should actually build it. But you have to build a sukkah. So he builds a sukkah. This guy does it for him after paying him. And fine, he goes to shul that night. He's happy. Ah, okay, at least I have a sukkah to sit in. He gets to shul and he realizes, you know, you have to have a guest in your sukkah. It's just, you know, he knows it's there's something wrong if you don't, and it's Yom Tov after all. And he goes around asking people, "Would you like to be my guest?" And of course, I mean, to get the opportunity to sit in Reb Pinchas of Karetz and his sukkah was, you know, people would die to such a thing. But nobody was interested. Nobody liked him, right? I mean, he prayed for it and he got what he prayed for. So, at the end, he has to go empty-handed back to his sukkah. No guests. And the story goes that he gets there. This is for the people who see the Ushpizin. And he sees Avram Avinu. It's the first night. Abraham, our father. And he's standing outside the sukkah. And our Pinchas of Kar says, "Please come in." And we all know Avram Avinu, right? He had his tent with a door on each side. Maybe also reminiscent of the sukkah, I don't know. A door on each side where it was always open to guests. And he says, "I'm sorry. I don't come to sukkahs without guests." So our Pinchas of Kar thought for a moment and he realized it's not worth it. Of course, he davened to Hashem, and Hashem listened to his prayers. And once again, Reb Pinchas of Karetz was well loved and beloved by his congregants. But it was all worth it to have the Ushpizin, to have the spiritual, the holy guests in his sukkah. And I'm sure you have more insights into that, but. You know, that's what sukkahs is. You have to feel, you know, like we said before, going out into God's protection. You know, in the house, I guess halacha allows you. You know, you have to invite guests. It's a mitzvah, nasat orchim. But you also have your own, you know, you have your own boundaries. It is your home. It's your privacy, and you know, and you decide how much you allow people in and this, that, but a sukkah just doesn't work. You need to have guests, you know.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, this is actually a very interesting dilemma all the way through any kind of spiritual quest, is the fact that on the one hand, you're doing it for yourself. You have to move forward. You have to learn. You have to contemplate. You have to, you know, pray in a deep way. And there are beautiful inner experiences that sometimes, you know, only by being alone can you really achieve. You know, even a very simple way. I sometimes ask yeshiva students and young girls as well of the same age, I say, do you ever go for a walk just by yourself? You know, just to think, to take stock. It was an issue in Poland in the 1930s when they saw the fallout that was taking place in the yeshiva world. Many people were dropping out of the yeshiva. And some scholar, I think it might have been the Piasechna Rebbe, who later became known as the Rebbe of the Warsaw Ghetto. He lived up till the Warsaw Ghetto. He was there. He died there as well, killed by the Nazis. But he taught, his teachings are collected in a book called Eish Kodesh, Holy Fire, and other books as well. So I think it was he who said that the problem, one of the problems is, one of the many problems, that there's not enough room in the yeshivas. Everyone is crowded together. They don't have enough space, like, to think, you know, to be, to have your own little space. So it's a very important thing. I was in a university library yesterday, a big library in the middle of London, University of London Library. And it's like millions of books, and there's like little, and you get like floor after floor with bookcase after bookcase. It's like a Borges story or something. Like it's an amazing thing, full of these books. And there are little cubby holes by the windows where just one, like, room for one student to sit with a book and maybe a laptop, I don't know, but, you know, just to be able to read by oneself, you know. So it's quite common in Jewish life in general that you're just surrounded by people all the time. Someone wrote an anthropological book about the shtetl. They interviewed people who'd come from Europe and were now living in America. And the book had an introduction by Margaret Mead, a famous anthropologist. And the book was called Life is with People. You know, because that's the whole tenor of Jewish life. So on the one hand, for spirituality, you need a certain quality called hisboidedus. Being alone, being thoughtful. And one of the Hasidic achievements was to be able to transform communal prayer into, or the whole prayer situation, into a time of hisboidedus, of being alone. Which they did either through very, very deep concentration during the prayer, so that although you're there in a room with 100 other people, you could just as well be in a forest by the edge of a stream, and, you know, you're alone with God, you know, wrapped up with God. That's whatever else is going on in the room, and you're like programmed to do the right responses at the right time. If everyone has to stand up for Kedusha or say Amen or something, you know, you do that, but you might be in another world inside yourself. Or there are Hasidim who pray after the prayers have finished. The great Chassid Reb Mendel Fuderfaster, there's a picture of him on the wall over there, I can see him. Reb Mendel Fuderfaster sitting with our Bodel Mechaim Lechaim, our Mashpia in the Lubavitch Yeshiva here, Rabbi Gordon. So Reb Mendel, he would come very early to the Minyan on a Shabbos morning, and he would study Hasidic teachings. There's always a Hasidic study group before the actual davening begins on Shabbos, and then through he would be there through the, you know, the davening, the reading of the Torah and so on, and then after, when everyone had gone, he would start davening. And with in a melodic way, in a very beautiful way, and there were people would come back to, like at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, to listen to the way he was davening. It was a very, very moving thing. Very beautiful. So that's one aspect of it. The solitude. And finding the opportunity to be alone, like Rabinus of Korets in the story. And then, there is the fact that we have to be able to open our hearts to another person. There's giving charity with money, but there's also giving charity with time. You know, that phoning someone up, giving that time, that attention to another person, and being accessible. It's an amazing thing. I can't do it. But a friend of mine, whenever anyone asks him, Rabbi Lutz or the Zangazon, whenever anyone asks him for anything, he's automatically got time for them. Yes, even though I know how phenomenally busy he is, and he actually hasn't got time, but he somehow made like a bubble of time, and there he is. He's able to talk to the person, make them feel wanted, and, you know, I'm the one, I always say, you know, immediately, sorry, I can't talk to you now. You know, and put everyone off. But he's able to do that. So together with being able to have the solitude as well. So that's the balancing act that we need to be able to achieve. And of course, in fact, I was writing a I was thinking about this. It's the difference between modernism and postmodernism. See, the modernist is in this like high elevated intellectual domain. But it really excludes anyone who can't match that. You know, if you can't listen to 12-tone music, then you're not in the group. Whereas the postmodernist will have both, somehow include both. You know, so that's really, you know, the goal, to be able to combine opposites. And that combination of opposites is very much what Sukkot is all about. Because we have the Lulav and the Esrog, and we're all familiar with a famous idea which comes from the Midrash and was emphasized in Chabad Hasidic teachings, and particularly by the Rebbe, with a sort of social application. The idea that the Etrog has both taste and fragrance, which represents Torah knowledge and action of the mitzvah, because the Etrog has a taste, like you can make it into jam, hint, hint. And it also has a nice fragrance. The lulav has a taste, making dates. It's a date palm, but no fragrance. So that represents Torah knowledge in itself, and Torah knowledge is so important that the lulav sticks out above all the other plants. And the normal word is, you know, in fact, the blessing is al netilas lulav. We make the lulav the main thing because that is Torah knowledge. You need Torah knowledge all the time. And then you have the myrtle, which is fragrance without taste, and that's just doing mitzvot, the practical action of mitzvot. And then you have the arava, the willow, which has neither fragrance nor taste. All of these different types have to be bound together in the mitzvah. You bind three of them and you hold the esrog to it, and that is the way in which we express the unity of all these different contrasting elements. Now, that unity of the bound of the different parts of the lulav and esrog, it's an expression of joy. There's a flow of life force coming through into the sukkah, and it's a joyful thing. But then we come tomorrow night to Shmini Atzeret. And Shmini Atzeret is the time when it says in the Torah, "Bayom HaShmini," on the eighth day, Atzeret Tiyelachem. That should be a day of stopping. It's an interesting word. And the people have come to Jerusalem for the foot festival, and the Pilgrim Festival, and now it's God is saying, stay another day. Stay another day. And there is an image that the Midrash gives, quoted a lot in Chabad Ma'amarim, Chabad Discourses, of a king who was making a party. And the party was for all his different princes, who are princes over the different dominions. And then at the end of the party, everyone's going home, and there's still food left on the table. And the king says to his beloved vizier, his very close friend, he says, look, everyone else is going home, but you stay with me. Boy negalgal iti, come, let's sit around among the tables. We'll find an ice cream here and some cake there, you know, like left on the table. We'll find something to eat together. You just be here with me. And that represents the idea that during Sukkot we offer 70 bulls in the temple, which represents giving life force through coming through the Jewish people in the land of Israel and the temple, spreading out to the 70 nations of the world. But then there comes the end of Sukkot, that's the seventh day, which is tonight and tomorrow, Hoshana Rabbah, it's the seventh day of Sukkot. And then comes the eighth day. And God says, right, okay, we have dealt with giving life force to the whole world. Now just you and me together. Now it's this moment of hitbodedut, of being alone with God. That sense of being alone with God. And in fact, outside Israel, we have 2 days. We have Shmini Atzeret and then Simchat Torah. And among the Chabad leaders, Shmini Atzeret, the tradition is that Shmini Atzeret was quite a serious day, even though there is dancing on Shmini Atzeret night. Tomorrow night there is dancing like Simchat Torah. But for the Rebbeim, although there was the dancing, it was also a sense of seriousness. And a discourse in which the Rebbe explains this, it's that we are really ascending to higher and higher levels of spirituality which are being revealed. And that takes place that on Sukkot there is a certain dimension which is being revealed in a joyful way. And in fact, what's being revealed is what began on Rosh Hashanah with 100 blasts of the shofar, which represents the schach of the sukkah, which has the gematria samach kof kof 60, 20 and 20, which is also 100. So that's like the blasts of the shofar bringing life force into the world. And then the cloud, Avram said that it's like the clouds of glory in the desert. There's the cloud of incense in the Holy of Holies when the high priest goes into the Holy of Holies. That's also the sukkah. But that on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, that's very serious. Come Sukkot, it's joyful, there's singing, there's dancing, there's playing music. But then, at the end of Sukkot, when we reach Shmini Atzeret, this being alone with the divine, where the full quality of the embrace of the Sukkah is there, in a sort of more, even more tangible form, then it's a more intense closeness to God. It's described as different levels of reaching higher and higher levels of the Sphira Keter. Like we spoke at the beginning, that what is Hasidic teaching? It's the Hamshacha, it's the flow of Keter into the world, crown, the point where world and infinite Ein Sof touch. And so it's drawing closer on that. And on Shmini Atzeres, it comes in a very intense and inward way, which has the quality of hitbodedut, of being alone almost. And there are serious dimensions to Shmini Atzeres. We pray for rain. We say Yiskom. There are various ways in which Shmini Atzeres, which is going to be Thursday, has a serious dimension. And then comes Simchat Torah, which outside Israel is another day. The next day, Friday, Thursday night and Friday. There we are at the very highest level of the spiritual, but it's in a way of revealed joy, and we're able to be with other people as well. Each person is, as it were, bonded with God through the Torah. God, the Jewish people, and the Torah are one, and we are all bonded to God through the Torah and with the Torah. And at the same time, there is this joyfulness, there's this togetherness. And so somehow or other there's the combination of the lonely and being together with people, that life is with people, and also that quality of being alone. There's a very beautiful saying in Hayom Yom, this little anthology of a little point for each day, like a diary, and each day there's a little Hasidic saying. So to appreciate it, let me first tell you something that a Jewish philosopher said. The philosopher Lev Shestov, who was a Russian Jewish philosopher at the beginning of the 20th century, he said, the last word of philosophy is loneliness. That's the last word. You go through all the different naturally he studied philosophy in Cambridge. You know, the last word in the last word of philosophy is loneliness. You know, you come to all different levels of thought, loneliness. So this is a saying by Rabbi Yosef Yitzhak, the sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe. He says, the reason why Hasidism began was so that the great scholar should not be lonely, and that the ordinary person, so to speak, the person in the street, should not be lonely. Before the rise of Hasidism, the great scholar was in a totally lonely bubble of his own, you know, like climbing higher and higher. And the ordinary person was, you know, studied Torah, kept mitzvah, but didn't have that bond with the great scholar. So, in a sense, was lonely. Hasidism opened the door between them. And so that the great scholar is not lonely. He suddenly got this flock to look after. And the person in the street is also not lonely, because he has that great scholar at his side. And so that is this bonding of the Jewish people at the same time as reaching for the highest levels of spirituality and holiness. Yossi, can you give us another nigger? A joyful nigger expressing the loneliness and joyfulness all at once. Right, I think that, thank God, the rain didn't come.
Ask a question.
Yes.
It's a question, really, which I'd really value hearing your comments on. it's not related to the sukkah so much as it is to the order of service over the chagim. And I was put in mind of it by the references to the fact that it's King David tonight, to do with the Psalms. In Hallel, the first of the Hallel Psalms, I can't remember the number, it's 31 or 30.
100.
It's a psalm that ends with a reference to Im Habanim Smicha, the happy mother of children. And it's about hope, the subject of hope. And I've been put in mind of it because we're reading Hallel so often at the moment. And the melody with which we sing this psalm is so beautiful and evocative. I was put in touch with a book by Rabbi Teichtal, Hungarian.
Oh yes, Imabonis.
Imabonis.
Right.
I just wanted to ask for some comment on the place of that book and the arguments in it, because it's a book written by a Hasidic rabbi who I can't place in the different schools of Hasidut, and he was one of the last rabbonim to construct an argument and have it published before they were all killed in Budapest. And the argument is an argument for Israel.
Yes, he basically is blaming the rabbinic leadership for not telling everyone to go to Israel because he could see the destruction of European Jewry, which was happening before his eyes. And he was thinking, as one could well understand someone thinking, that if they would have all gone to Israel, then everything would have been all right. They'd have all been saved. And my own perspective of this, my mother, Leah Shalom, was in Israel during the war, and I was born towards the end of the war. And my mother remembers very well what it was like when Rommel, was the German commander, was approaching Israel along the coast of North Africa. The way everyone saw, this is the end. And then, thank God, by a miracle, Mountbatten conquered him. And the Jews of Israel were saved. So, you know, to know exactly what is going to happen and where is the place to be, maybe, you know, who knows what was the force, the spiritual force of the extinction, apparent extinction of European Jewry. One way of understanding that is that those souls are eternal. They all died al kiddush Hashem, for the sanctification of the divine name, even if they didn't know why they were being killed, or they didn't identify very closely with the Judaism for which they were being killed. And that sets up a tremendous spiritual force which I believe is leading the world towards the next stage of history in a positive way. And so those rabbis who advise staying there, they, you know, the advice that they were given, no one said don't go to America. You know. And the problem was that America and Britain did not let anyone in, you know. So they wouldn't let people into Israel either. I mean, just to get to Israel, for my mother to get a green card or whatever it was to enable her to go to Israel in 1933 from London, you know, which was an amazing thing, was very, very hard. And they very virulently wouldn't let Jews in, you know. But so look, Im Habanim Smecha was written, and it's a voice. There were statements of different varieties, very much understood,
of despair of different kinds. On the other hand, you have the Apiat Shena Rebbe's Eish Kodesh, the Holy Fire, where he speaks about the plight of the Jews in the Holocaust as God weeping, and that divine weeping is part of the story. So we have to come from the point of God weeping to God and the whole world rejoicing with the coming of Mashiach. Okay, L'chaim. Wish everyone a very good Yom Tov and wonderful Shmini Atzeret, Simchas Torah. If we all get whisked away to Israel very quickly, especially with the coming of Mashiach, we will have just one day, Shmini Atzeret and Simchas Torah combined, but since it will be the coming of Mashiach, we will be able to all do what's called Hakofos Shnios, the second set of Hakofos later on, as many people do in Israel anyway. So, would you like to say the Nach Bracha? You had something of everything? Yeah. So if you listen to Rabbi Sitch and say Amen, then you will be Yoitze, the after blessing on this very nice spread that David and Nicola provided, for which we thank them. And the next share here will be next Tuesday evening with the help of God, exploring a Hasidic discourse.
Baruch ata Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam al hamechya ve'al hakalkala ve'al hagefen v'pri hagefen v'al ha'etz v'al pri ha'etz v'al tenuvas ha'sada v'al ha'aretz chemda tova urechav asher atzisa v'inchalta l'avesinu l'achol mipirya v'lespoya mituva rachem na Adonai Eloheinu al Yisrael amecha v'al Yerushalayim yerecha v'al tzion mishkan kvedecha v'al mizbechecha v'al hechalecha uv'nei Yerushalayim ir hakodesh meher v'yaminu ועלינו לסייך, ושמחנו בה, ונברכך בקדושה ובטהרה. וזכרנו לטובה ביום חג הסוכס הזה. כי אתה אדוני טוב ומיטיב לכל, ונודה לך על הארץ ועל המחיה ועל פרי הגפן ועל הפרס. ברך אתה אדוני על הארץ ועל המחיה והפרס והגפן.
Amen.
Now, too much food over here. Mazonas, wine, everything.
Shkoyach. Thank you very, very much indeed, and a great thank you to Yossi Nigan for giving us that beautiful extra dimension.
Nobody wants to get out.
Yossi, do you want to play a niggun to attract everyone into the other room? a last thing. Yeah, it's a very moving issue. The whole.
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much.
I'll tell them that you're coming.